Welcome back to episode 215 of the Tall Boy Radio podcast. And as we always say, who knows where it goes when the beer flows? Well, Gary, where are you going to take it tonight?
Well, I'm going to take it to places that we've never been before and probably back again and probably along the way a couple of left turns. Look, it's good to be back to TBR HQ. It feels like it's been a while since I've been here, actually, to be fair. So a couple of episodes where I've recorded from home due to illnesses and various other things. So good to be back at TBR HQ. Looking forward to this episode. And as we say, you know, when we have guests on, it's always a bonus. It's fantastic. And particularly first-time guests. So really, really, really looking forward to this episode. Who knows where it goes?
Indeed, indeed. Dave, is this subject that we're going to talk about tonight, is it something you're passionate about?
Passionate about? Well, I guess in a sense, because you can't really avoid it. But I am really interested because I think this is one of those topics where everybody thinks they probably know a lot about it, and we're probably going to learn that there's quite a lot we don't know and quite a lot we got wrong at the same time. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
Indeed. I think you're right on the money there, Dave. So it's one of those things that are facts, but most people are listening to other people's opinions. So we have an expert tonight. We're going to put our questions to him. No pressure. And Andrew, did you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about the subject that we're going to be talking tonight and why you are interested in it?
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Adam, Gaz and Dave. I'm really looking forward to this tonight. I don't know what to expect, but I'm sure it's going to be an interesting hour. So I'm Andrew. For the many of your viewers that actually don't know me, so I'm an academic and I do work on climate change. So I specifically do work related to climate change policy, politics, and why people actually take action on climate change. And I'm based at the University of Lincoln. So that's my day job. I do have other sort of jobs attached to my academic role as well. So I'm also a Lincoln Climate Commissioner. So I set up the Lincoln Climate Commission when I first moved to the University of Lincoln in 2019. So I do a lot of policy-facing work related to climate change.
Indeed, indeed. So, there's a number of people who have a number of different opinions about climate change, but what we're trying to do tonight is probably look at some of the facts, tell us about some of the stuff that we've likely got wrong, and what we need to know and what we need to do to take action ourselves. So with that in mind, is climate change a real thing?
I get asked this question a lot by the layperson on the street. And yes, climate change is real. So for your viewers, we have two types of, and listeners, we have two types of climate change. So we have a thing called geological climate change, which is related to different processes of the Earth and the Sun, and this stretches back millions of years. We've always had climate changing over millions of years. The second type of climate change, which I think we'll be talking about more tonight, is what we call anthropogenic climate change or human-induced climate change. So this is the climate change that's been produced in the last 300 years because of the industrialization, because of the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, we've emitted greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So your listeners might have heard of carbon dioxide. So that's the main greenhouse gas. And this is probably what we're going to be talking about a lot tonight. It's the anthropogenic emissions that has been quite contentious within society as to whether people believe in climate change or not.
I think for me, like, what I hope that we get out of tonight is a little bit of myth busting, is a little bit of, you know, putting to bed some of the misconceptions and the misperceptions surrounding climate change. And I think it's important to sort of emphasize what you've just said there, Andrew, in terms of, you know, the world as we know it has been going through climate change for since the day dot. You know, there are certain sort of geological features that would dictate certain atmospheric features that would dictate climate change, and that is a process that's happening all the time. I think what we need to get to the bottom of is, since the industrialization of civilization, is the impact that has. And I think that's where really I'm coming from, is you know, I'm not naive, although we might have some listeners that maybe are that don't understand that the climate is changing all the time just through a natural process, but actually it's the impact of the human race and what we're doing that either accelerates that, and it actually, can we get to a point where we can reverse that? And I think for me, that's where we need to get to, and that's what I'm looking forward to finding out. And like I say, perhaps busting a couple of myths surrounding sort of climate change, because let's face it, you know, the tabloids have a habit of sort of sensationalizing things and perhaps not reporting on exactly what is the truth. So I'm fascinated by the subject, and I'm fascinated to know where this can go.
Yeah. And I think you probably already hit on one myth already, in terms of there's an idea that it's either or. It's either the planet is just warming up because that's the nature of the beast. You know, it goes in those peaks and troughs, and we're heading towards warmer parts. Maybe so. Or it's caused by man. And there's an idea that those two things are mutually exclusive. It's either or. Well, actually, the two can both be true. And that's what we're obviously going to look at tonight. So the other thing that I want to look at as well, and it's interesting because you say about politics and that's at the side of things that you're interested in. So we call this episode basically, "You're to Blame for Climate Change." You, I, David, Gaz here, we're all responsible in our own individual way, because there's that feeling in terms of politically, it feels like there's finger pointed. You know, it's your carbon footprint, you're the problem. Is that fair? Is it fair to point the finger at the average Joe on the street and say, it's all down to you, sunshine?
Yeah, well, I think I'm an average Joe as well. So it is all down to us as humans and the consumption that we actually take part in as a society. So society is based on a fossil fuel infrastructure. So we dig for coal, we exploit gas reserves, we use oil, and burning fossil fuels results in emissions of greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, but there are other greenhouse gases as well. But carbon dioxide is in the most abundance in the atmosphere, and that has a warming effect. So, and as a result of that warming effect, we've seen unprecedented rises in temperature over the last 250 years. So we're looking at around, I think that the average, because there's recordings taking place all over the world, about in the last 100 years, it's been about 1.1 degrees C of warming. So, and this is when when people watch the news and they see things on the Paris Agreement and they see stuff on the Conference of the Parties that happens around the end of November, this is what they're talking about at the Conference of the Parties, to limit global temperatures below 2 degrees C, trying to aim for 1.5 degree by 2100, because we're experiencing the impacts now of all of this increased warming. So the flooding that you see, the heat waves, it's all related to anthropogenic warming.
So what? One of the things, I mean, I'm fascinated by, and I understand that, you know, Earth is in a stasis of equilibrium and a slight shift here or there. And you mentioned like 1.1 degree. Now, you know, if I'm sitting on a sunny Sunday afternoon in the summer and I've got my budgie smugglers on and I'm thinking, well, it's 20 degrees. Oh, it's gone up to 21 degrees or what? All right, Dave, don't shake your head, you know. And you think, well, that's gone up from 20 degrees to 21 degrees or whatever. That's just a 1 degree increase. That doesn't, to me, feel significant. But from a climate change point of view, I suspect it probably is significant. So if you could just sort of, in layman's terms, maybe explain some of the effects of a 1 degree increase that we might see in various parts of the world, because I think that would be really important just for our listeners, just to put into context, actually just such a small or a perceived small change would make.
Yeah. Well, 1 degree doesn't seem like a lot. When it gets to 2 or 3 degrees, so current projections are by 2100, we'd be hitting around three degrees more than we're experiencing now. We'll have, in the UK, I'm just trying to think about what the impacts in the UK would be. So if you cast your mind back to the heat wave that we had in 2022, we got temperatures that exceeded 40 degrees C. Yeah. Just down the road from me, in fact, in Coningsby in Lincolnshire, we would see that type of temperature more frequently during British summers. And that is unprecedented. So we'd be getting, instead of, say, maybe a 40-degree day once in every 3 years, we'd be getting it more regularly every single summer.
Right.
So that's the difference that we'd see in temperature. When you look at the, there is a big difference between even the 1.5-degree threshold that I talked about and the 2-degree that Paris is trying to go for. But because even just with half a degree of warming, the amount of impacts are exacerbated completely. So I haven't got any stats on hand, yeah, but the impacts are really, really exacerbated just with that half a degree extra warming.
Sorry, in terms of my limited understanding, the particular issues is the ice that melts, and the ice that melts that A is locks up a lot of the carbon dioxide in the first place, but B, once it melts, it's putting cold water into the ocean, which is then going to affect all the biodiversity in the ocean, as well as raising the levels of the ocean. But also, once the ice is melted, it's very difficult to get it back again. So it becomes a bit, it sort of accelerates once you get
past it. That's right, yes. Because this is all to do with ice cover. So if we look at ice, if we have a lot of ice, say in Antarctica or in the North Pole, it's white and it's got what we call an albedo effect. So it actually reflects the sun back out into space.
Right.
Once that melts, it becomes ocean water. Then the carbon is more absorbed into the oceans. So the oceans are our biggest carbon sink. So that and you're exactly right, Dave. We get that sort of double jeopardy because of that. Because we're melting the polar ice caps, and that is creating that ocean that actually absorbs the heat rather than reflecting it back into outer space like ice would actually do. So that's why we get that problem.
So I'm making an assumption then that if or when the polar ice caps melt and it becomes an ocean, does that then become very, very carbon rich? Does that then affect the marine life, the plant life and the coral reefs, etc. So that then becomes so carbon rich that some of the life forms that are marine based can't sustain, and which then has a knock-on effect, etc.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that I'm not actually a physical climate scientist, so I'm just racking my brains there. But what would happen? A good example is when the oceans absorb the carbon and the ocean becomes more acidic, and that's why we're seeing things like coral bleaching, because the temperature of the water changes and it becomes more acidic as well, and so you can't get that coral growing. So, you know, we've seen all over the world, and we're seeing it now, particularly in the Great Barrier Reef. And I'm sure many of your listeners have watched, you know, programs like Planet Earth with David Attenborough talking about that sort of
thing. Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. And as you said, it's a double jeopardy. It's actually a treble jeopardy, because at 40 degrees, Gaz puts his budgie smugglers away and gets his thong out. So it's much worse. It's much worse than we first imagined. So In terms of you, me, I, everyone, so what difference do I need to make in the way that I live to have an effect? And how do I then encourage my colleagues and cohorts and friends and anybody I know I bump into the street? How do we go about encouraging them to make a difference as well?
Yeah. Well, the problem is, I think climate change is quite an emotive subject, and we have different people all over the world that believe different things about climate change. So if you take your average member of Extinction Rebellion, they may want to do what the layperson would see as quite extreme actions. So they'd probably become vegan, they wouldn't eat meat, they wouldn't fly anywhere. But this is quite unrealistic to the average person, and me included, because I like to go on holidays myself. I'm not going to shy away from that fact. But that's because we're locked into this carbon economy, this infrastructure, and a lot of people don't actually have any choice in their decisions. They think that they do have free will, but they don't in a way. We are forced to live in a certain lifestyle. So I think this is one of the problems that we have with climate change. And I think with respect to maybe the average person on the street, what they can actually do, they don't have to give up meat if they don't want to. Maybe they can just, instead of eat meat, say, 5 or 6 days a week, which they might ordinarily do, just cut it out for 2 or 3 days. and maybe thinking about the types of meat that they actually eat. So the most carbon intensive forms of meat are probably red meat, beef and lamb. So you could probably try eating a different meat, chicken or maybe pork, which is still carbon intensive in their own ways, but not as much as beef and lamb. And there are other environmental benefits as well. It's not just about carbon, because, you know, trying to, you know, if you're trying to graze cattle, that takes a lot of water as well. So there are other resources that you can actually save on as well. So that's just one example of how people can actually change their lifestyle. And maybe think, just try and think about what they're doing and the environmental impact that it may have, and just maybe mitigate that some way in their own personal choices. So it's not about being everyone to being extreme. And I think a lot of advocates of climate change would actually probably agree with me that, you know, we wouldn't expect, or even the government wouldn't expect people to actually completely change their consumer choices, because governments have an active interest in things that are actually carbon intensive as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, an example of that is a couple of weeks ago, the government just granted some more licenses to drill for oil in the North Sea, which will bring the government a lot of money in tax revenues of fossil fuel companies.
Yeah,
very true, very true. So I guess if we're looking how we deal with something collectively, then maybe if I think back, because, you know, we're of that age that we can remember the stories of the ozone layer being diminished. So I know it's not related necessarily directly to this, but in terms of the ozone layer, it's on its way to be repaired. We control the use of chlorofluorocarbons and very stuff good. Like well that. Done. Thank you very much. I remember that one. So from my GCSE geography. And that's the only thing I did learn in GCSE. I got there before you said it. So yeah, in terms of that then, so how do we deal with that one collectively?
Well, comparisons have been made with the ozone layer. So, you know, when us guys were all young in the 80s, they talked about the hole in the ozone layer and it being over Antarctica and it being caused by CFCs that you talked about, you know, fridges. That was the thing, wasn't it? Fridges, the CFCs released from that. And the issue with ozone is slightly different, because we had a lot of governments came on board. You might have heard of the Montreal Protocol, which was signed in the mid-1980s, 1987 or something like that. And all governments worked towards sort of reducing their CFCs. And now the ozone layer above Antarctica is actually repairing itself now. So that's an example of an environmental policy at the global scale that's been quite successful. With climate change, it's a bit different. And that's to do with the fact that, like I explained earlier, we're locked into this fossil fuel economy, and certain countries are very much dependent on fossil fuels for their economic development. Whereas within the ozone layer issue, countries weren't dependent on CFCs for their economic development in the same way as that they are for climate change. And that's why we have these actually issues with climate change and a lot of disagreement that we see at the global scale through the framework convention, the climate change process, the global climate regime, with countries arguing with each other. So, for example, at the last conference of the parties, which was ironically held in Dubai, which is an archetypal fossil fuel state, we had a lot of arguments with least developed countries, or like countries like in the South Pacific, for example, small island states that are already experiencing the impacts at a really high level, arguing with the historical global north on why they should be curbing their greenhouse gas emissions more. So we haven't all of these political problems because of that, which is very different to the Montreal Protocol and the ozone experience, the ozone layer experience.
So, in terms of sort of, you know, the political landscape, and if we get past the everybody's going to go to the G12 summit or whatever, and we're going to talk about climate change, and everybody's going to fly in on their like planes and pollute the environment even more, and all of that sort of, and you hear that, you know, it's like all these world leaders, and we're going to talk about climate change, and then they're all going to jump on their plane and fly to various places. Let's forget that. But from a political point of view, then, in terms of the targets that either governments or regimes set to be carbon neutral, to be net zero, and all of that, how, wow, this is like $64,000 question, I suppose. How easy is it to say to a populace in a country, you all need to be doing this in order for us to meet the targets that we all agree that we should be meeting? Because, you know, you're going to get, and not necessarily myself, Adam and Dave, who I would like to think are relatively intelligent human beings, you're going to get some people who go, well, I can't make a difference. That's not me. I'm only one in 60 odd million people in the UK and one in however many millions and millions and millions of people over the earth. So what difference can I make? So how easy is it for these governments to sort of say that they're going to try to be net zero, carbon neutral and all of that by a particular time frame? And then how easy is it to then roll out sort of procedures and policies in order to meet that?
Yeah. Well, it's actually very difficult for governments, because for me personally, I think a lot of people say to solve the climate crisis. I think it's very difficult to solve the climate crisis. Maybe we should talk about it in maybe tackling the climate crisis, if there is a crisis at all. But that's another argument that we may get onto later on.
Yeah.
But governments are going to find it very, very difficult, because, and government would admit that themselves. And I think it's down to the general public, it's down to us as individuals to look at our everyday practices and then try and change an aspect of those practices. Because, you know, it's going to be the power of the people that actually does, that actually tackles this crisis, not governments. The governments can put in policies, but the governments aren't going to stop me from going out and buying a 20-ounce steak, are they? They wouldn't encroach on my right to do that. So, you know, it is going to be down to the preferences of individuals, our actual behaviours, to actually try and tackle the crisis. But government can provide some of the levers that will enable us to do that.
Right. I suppose my follow-up question is, if the UK government suggests that by whatever date, 2040, 50, 60, whatever it may be, we're going to be carbon neutral and this, that, and the other. What are the potential sanctions for the governments that then don't hit their targets? You know, so when they all meet around the table and they say, well, we can pledge this and we can pledge this and we can do this, and they're all trying to do it for the greater good, I suppose. What are the sanctions on the governments if they don't then hit their targets? Because effectively, what you're saying is we're going to hold the government to ransom, but the government then can't hold to ransom each individual within their government, because that's very hard, because you've civil liberty and all of that, and everybody is entitled to express their own free will. And as you just said, you can go out and buy a 20-ounce steak and you can eat it if you want. So how do, I don't know, France, Germany, Italy, America, whoever it is that hold the UK to sort of account, what are the sanctions? How does that even work?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, when we look at the global scale through the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the sanctions are actually very, very weak. So, right. You know, a simple example is when Donald Trump won the US election in 2017, he immediately withdrew from the Paris Agreement. And when you're looking at a country like the United States withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, and their emissions probably total around, I don't know, 15 to 18% maybe of total global greenhouse gas emissions, then we have a big problem.
Yeah.
And that goes with China as well. That's, you know, over 20% of global emissions that they withdrew. Then, you know, when you look at it as a whole, those two nations, if they withdrew, it's, you know, nearly at least nearly a third or even more of total global greenhouse gas emissions. So the problem is, in the politics that we see in climate change at the global scale, it's very weak. And countries often try to think about their own territorial and sovereign interests when it comes to negotiating a deal on climate change. And that's why we see this sort of, I'd say, this dichotomy between global south countries that are experiencing the impacts really, really badly, and global north countries that actually aren't experiencing the impacts, even though we do experience the impacts, but not as badly as we see in some areas of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, small island states in the South Pacific and the Caribbean, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart asked a question there asking about the net zero targets, but I think, guys, you sort of covered that off a little bit in terms of your question there, yeah. Didn't you? So just taking it back then a little bit, so in terms of how we dealt with the ozone crisis, then in terms of that, I mean, like you say, it's very, very different because, you know, we are all tied in that we need, our economy is built around carbon, the use of carbon. And as Stuart rightly points out, Rishi Sunak has had to move the date back for the use and sale of petrol cars because we just simply aren't in a position to produce that amount of electricity to make that feasible. So it's somehow then we need our governments to take action really almost on our behalf. Not, I'm not asking them to take our choices away. I think we know, but
that's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's the problem that you've got, is that we need the government to act and almost create statute or policy or whatever. But the flip side to that is we then don't want them to take away our civil liberty and our freedom to express our own views and our own opinions. And that's your catch 22, isn't it? That's...
No, for me though, so in terms of you or I producing carbon, there's a lot of industry out there which produces a lot more carbon than you and I could, you know, and that's before we start blaming Taylor Swift flying back and forward to watch the Kansas City Chiefs all year long. But, you know, in the industry, how comfortable do you feel about the phrase carbon offsetting as well?
I'm quite comfortable with it. It's we should be offsetting carbon, but often that's actually we try to internalize environmental costs within our economic development. So this is a thing called ecological modernization of the state, and that's what we're currently seeing with a lot of countries at the moment. They're sort of internalizing environmental harm within their economic policy, which could be quite actually detrimental when we think of actually trying to solve the climate change crisis. With net zero, I think it's a really funny thing because, you know, this idea of net zero has just lurched into the public consciousness probably the last 5, 6, 7 years. And I think that's very dangerous because we're trying to totalize the climate change issue through this idea of net zero. And climate change is so much more than that. So, you know, when we're paying all this attention to net zero, we're also precluding other areas of climate change that we should be looking at. So I'm thinking in the first instance of adaptation. So net zero is what we call climate mitigation. So climate mitigation is basically stopping the amount of greenhouse gases that we're spewing into the atmosphere so we can actually lower the effects of global warming. Whereas adaptation is trying to deal with the carbon that's already locked into the system. So even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases tomorrow, the climate would still change over the next 10, 20, 30 years. The temperature would still rise because of the residence times of carbon in the atmosphere. It's very, very complex chemistry up there in the atmosphere. And when we look at climate change, and this is another thing as well, when we look at climate change, it's spread over, we understand it's spread over 30 or 40 years, which is very different to weather, which we just see outside when we look outside our window maybe tomorrow and it's raining. So that this is, you know, people, and when we see Trump tweets that say, oh, it's snowing here, they're talking about global warming, that's actually quite disingenuous because snowing is weather and climate change is over longer periods of time. So we will get periods when we have hotter, but because we have global warming, we will have periods where we have quite intense rainfall and we have sort of, which would cause flooding as well. And we will have snowfalls as well at unusual times as well.
So with net zero, I think trying to, my own head sort of simplify it down so that I can understand it. You're saying, I think, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but net zero is a bit of a buzzword. and you can achieve net zero, for example, by burning more fossil fuels and planting more trees. And companies essentially say, yeah, we're going to burn a load of fossil fuels, but don't worry, we're planting more trees. And if you took that to the nth degree, you can have half the planet planted with trees and the other half of the planet just burning fossil fuels endlessly, and that's not good.
Yeah, exactly. So net zero is just trying to get the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting in the atmosphere down to zero, basically. And if you're obviously burning carbon, you will need to make up for that by things like, you know, afforestation. So, you know, growing more trees to absorb the carbon. There are other technologies as well. So, you know, there's various different technologies that we can actually use to offset carbon. Afforestation is one of the ones that probably a lot of your listeners have heard of, but there's also other areas as well. So there's solar radiation management as well, but that's quite dangerous. I can talk more about that if you want, but at the moment, the carbon offsetting, we use carbon dioxide removal. Okay. Right. That's one of the areas that we're actually looking at. And these are all geoengineering the climate, which is very, very scary idea, really, in a lot of senses. You know, we see it in a lot of Hollywood movies about geoengineering the climate to try and decrease temperatures and stuff. And things like having big reflectors as well that would reflect sunlight back out into space. But the problem is with geoengineering techniques like that, it reduces the warming, it will reduce the warming, but it doesn't alter the core problem of us emitting greenhouse gases and, yeah, you know, from human consumption. So we can keep on doing that. So rather than fixing the problem, we're just putting a band-aid over it if we use geoengineering techniques.
Yeah. And for me, it's something that you said a little bit earlier in terms of industry and economies, and lots of economies are set up for carbon emission. And unfortunately, if you turn around and said, and again, sort of taking it to the nth degree, I suppose, if you turn around and said, well, we can't do this and we can't do that because of the carbon emissions, what that means is the impact of reducing all of those industries that we are so reliable on mean that actually the standard of life and living and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that we are accustomed to is less. So it's a catch 22 in terms of we're so reliable on the industries that we currently rely on for our heating and our gas and our electric and everything else is that actually, if you turn around and said, well, actually they're the root cause of climate change, and therefore we're going to just stop that completely, and because we're emitting too much carbon into the atmosphere, well, life wouldn't survive and our economy wouldn't survive because of the impact, and I'm talking to the nth degree, you know, the impact of that would have on multiple economies across the world would mean that the world would just collapse, and therefore it just becomes a shit show, effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, I think you're right, because it changes. If we can't just change this overnight. There does have to be some sort of transition, because we are reliant on this fossil fuel economy. We have to wean ourselves off it very, very carefully, and with the right policies as well, not just thinking about this idea of net zero. Even though I'm not trying to bag net zero out, because in a lot of senses it is a good idea. But when we get, say, take for instance local councils in the United Kingdom. You may have heard from your local council that they have a net zero target by 2050. Other councils, like Lincoln, where I'm on the Lincoln Climate Commission, they have a net zero policy for 2030. But the neighbouring Lincolnshire County Council have 2050, and that UK statutory obligation is 2050. So when we get different councils having different dates to go net zero, you can see how it's become politically contentious, and that is all down as well to a certain extent to power the ideology of the council. So typically conservative run councils would be more 2050. Labour-run councils would be 2030. They would probably try to show more ambition.
Hmm. That's interesting. And again, so you say there with it being politically led, and you know, I'm not going to start bashing any single political
are you
party,
not?
As I may have done in the past. But the challenges that they face in terms of change, you know, like you say, it's tied in around the world. So it's not just our politics; it's global politics as well. Yeah. As Gaz said, it isn't something you can change overnight, but there does seem to be a need to, first of all, plan it a little bit so that we can sort of see what those changes are looking like, whether nuclear power is the way answer is, you know, as Elon Musk has maybe suggested, what we need to do to physically get enough power and cleaner power in the UK. But the other side of it as well is the message. Like you say, in terms of people believing things and having opinions on stuff, that, for me, is where the British government, regardless of who's in power, needs to do a little bit more to make someone like me, my next-door neighbour, him,
me?
Is, yeah, or anybody else, care about it. Because my fear is, like you say, there's extreme people who care or glue themselves to the road and not eat meat, which, by the way, I have no problem with myself. However, you know, it's probably not realistic for everybody, and I get that. But it's getting the, you know, not, I don't want to use the average person, but there's plenty of people out there who couldn't give a monkeys, you know, yeah, in terms of they ain't going to be affected by it. He'll have his budgie smugglers on. He'll be happy as Larry, you know, and I'm, like I say, as his next donate, will be less pleased. But how do we get that message out? How do the government change people's mind? What is the message that's actually going to make people care?
Well, I'm going to be political now. I think the message that we're receiving from the current government is very, very mixed. And I just saw one of the comments from one of your viewers, listeners, and they said, they talked about, yeah, this is it, from Stuart. He talked about Rishi Sunak had to move the date for the use and sale of petrol cars from 2030 to 2035, which shows a lack of climate ambition. And this is the problem. We're having inconsistent policies in the UK on climate change at the moment. And, you know, this led to the resignation of Chris Skidmore, most recently, who did the independent report on net zero. And he was saying that the government aren't committed to net zero in the way that it actually should be. And when we get all these mixed messages from government with respect to climate policy, what does that tell the electorate? How does that affect the electorate? And we do get ambivalence because of that. So we need clearer policies from government, not contradictory policies, so then people can actually follow suit and actually say, you know, this government is actually doing something real about climate change. They're having consistent policies, so maybe we can do something that's consistent as well. So I don't hold much faith personally in not just the Conservative government. Maybe if the Labour government came in, we'd still be seeing similar issues. With political power per se, more generally, I have some issues with respect to climate action. So, you know, a lot of work needs to be done. The government, like I said earlier, does have a place in actually trying to persuade the general public to change their ways. But I think at the end of the day, it's down to personal choice. And I think we really need to consider how future generations would actually feel if we didn't try to solve this issue now. And this is why we have the problems that we're seeing now with climate anxiety amongst younger people. You know, not just about, you know, we're in a post-COVID world now, but, you know, in 100 years' time, we'll be talking about COVID, a post-COVID world. We might be talking about a post-climate world or a post-carbon world with a bit of luck. But I think the climate change is the problem that we're actually going to look back on in 100 years' time and say maybe we should have done more about it.
Yeah. And it's interesting just because, so I'm in education. There's a guy called Simon Sinek who has done a lot of research and a lot of work from an educational point of view, but also from an organisational point of view. And And he talks about, and part of his research, and his famous research, is something called Start With Why. And many, many organizations say, we'll do this, and we'll do this, and we'll do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And they start with the how and the what. And actually, it's really, really important to start with the why. And his really, I suppose, not hard-hitting, but his famous piece of research and literature is Start With Why. So if you can get people to understand why you're making the decisions and why you're doing the things that you're going to do, you almost get, I suppose, a buy-in. You almost get them coming along with you, and they feel as though they understand the rationale, and therefore that they feel as though they're part of the decision, as opposed to, and they're being done with, as opposed to done to. So if you can start with the why, and it's to, a lot of it's to do with organizational change and how you go about that, but it sort of works in my rudimentary understanding in terms of a government, in terms of how they influence populace, is if you can try to get the populace to understand why we're doing the things. Why is it important? Why are we making these decisions? What's the rationale behind it? What's the justification behind it? Once you get to that point, then you can start with, and that's your strategic stuff. Then you can start to get with the operational stuff. Is that actually, okay, so how are we going to do it? What are we going to do? And that's almost the nuts and bolts on the ground. But to start with that very strategic, why are we doing it? And I think that's the message that has to come out from lots of governments to the general populace. I mean, as I said earlier, and myself, Dave, Adam, I'd like to think we're relatively intelligent guys, so we might be easy to convert and to rationalize with, but there'll be people out there that you really need to get them to understand why we need to do this, A, for now, B, for future generations, and C, for future generations, because actually, you know, we could be in a serious hole in X number of years, you know. So starting with the why, and I think that has to come from government, from central government, from local government, from county, from council, whatever it may be, in terms of these are the reasons why it's really important.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, just Andrew, you mentioned, and it links into what Gaz has just said. You talked about young people, and what Gaz is saying is the why and getting people to understand. And Albert's put a question. Now, Albert, he's 15, he's my son, but he's quite environmentally conscious, but he's put this as a question, and I guess, you know, should we as humans spend more money to help maintain our planet's climate, or should we basically just spend money on spaceships and just give up and go? And I guess that links into the young people, the understanding the why, because is there a danger that whole generations are sucked into this? It's never going to happen. The political message is never consistent, therefore they ignore it. It's not real, it's not me. And is there a danger that people just give up and think we will just be saved by going to space, so let's not bother?
Yeah, well, I don't think the solution is actually going building spaceships to escape the planet. I don't know, technologically, would that be an option at the moment? I'm not sure. I have to talk to Elon Musk about that. But we should be spending more money to actually maintain our planet's climate, or to maintain it at a level where the Earth is actually habitable. And that's very difficult as well when we're locked into this fossil fuel economy. So we have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. I don't think it's a tricky question to answer, because we should be maintaining our planet's climate and making those changes ourselves. We may need to, we have to change our lifestyle, really, because this is the Earth that's given us a wake-up call with what's happening. And just think, this is just 250 years of fossil fuel exploitation. Just if you imagine the lifespan of the Earth, and in just 250 years, we've had unprecedented amounts of temperature increases throughout, you know, recorded history of the Earth. We've had the Earth, like we talked about very early on in the program, we have, you know, the geological climate change. So we have these peaks and troughs that you talked about of global warming and global cooling. But the issue is, it's so unprecedented, the amount of temperature increase we've had in the last 250 years, that we need to do something about it. And we need a strong government to actually show people that we can actually tackle this. But moreover, we need strong governments that are the more powerful governments in the world. So I'm thinking about, on the global scale, we are looking at the USA, we are looking at China, we are looking at India as well. highly populated countries that also want to develop as well, and that is their argument, that they want to develop and they should be exploiting fossil fuels in the same way that global north countries did from the 19th century. That's quite a fair argument that you can't really oppose, because mm-hmm. we need equality, we need parity as well. But maybe we can solve that to some extent by offering those countries certain technologies to develop their renewable capabilities. And this is what we've seen the global climate regime try to do through the Kyoto Protocol and now yeah. the Paris Agreement. So the Kyoto Protocol had what we call flexibility mechanisms that would enable countries to, a richer developed country, to share technologies with a lower country, a lower developing country, but for the exchange of what we call carbon credits. That's another issue as well. Treating carbon as a commodity as well, in the same way that we would do the price of gold, is very, very problematic for someone yeah. like me. I think it's a really problematic issue trying to commodify carbon in that way, especially when the system sometimes oversells carbon credits as well. We're still exacerbating the global warming problem with that.
A question that I've got for you, Andrew, is, and you mentioned that the bigger nations, the more developed nations, so the UK, America, China, etc., etc. How easy is it to, if you were to look at some of the third world nations, third world countries that aren't perhaps as industrialized as the Western world and so on, how easy is it to get to them governments and say, well, don't make the same mistakes that we made 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years ago, whatever it may be? How easy is it to get to those governments to get them to change their thinking? Because actually they're not industrialized yet. They're not developed to the same state that we are. And they're going to go through, I assume, without being a geopolitics expert, so they, but they're going to go through the same process that we went through 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whatever it may be, to get to the point that we are now.
The problem is global north countries have exploited global south countries for their fossil fuels and
yeah.
their natural resources, and that's the problem. I don't think that in the future those sort of least and less developed countries would be actually able to exploit fossil fuels, because I think global north countries would have already exploited them.
Right.
So, yeah. you know, that's going to be the problem. And, you know, we may see a very, very different world in 500, 600 years' time. I know none of us would be here then, but, you know, what legacy do we want to leave?
Yeah.
We're going to say, you know, those people in the 21st century didn't do enough to actually deal with the problem there and then when they had the capacity to do so.
Yeah. And if the third world countries or the globe, you know, the carbon south countries are not able to develop to the point that we would want them to, is that, well, what's their alternative then? If we've already stripped them of all of their fossil fuels and all of their natural resources because we've exploited them, where does that leave them? And therefore, effectively, the divide that you get from the northern countries and the southern countries gets even bigger and even bigger.
Yeah.
So you're going to get a significant portion of the world's population that are massively affected by this.
Yeah, well, as a result of this, and this is already in discussions, the links between climate change and migration, we're going to get mass migration from
yeah.
areas like, we're already seeing it now, you know, caused by climate change. So we're going to get mass migration from, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. So there'll be more landmass being used to populate more people.
Yeah.
And then with that, we will have stronger, more demand for resources, and would exacerbate the problems even further. So this is going to be the main problem. So, you know, we're already seeing migration as a very, very emotive issue in, you know, global north countries all over the world. And,
yeah.
you know, the issues with migration that come out of Brexit, they're, you know, things like that, they are deeply related to climate change as well. And this is what people need to resonate with as well. everyone's lives resonates with climate change in some way, shape or form. And what I would encourage a lot of your listeners to do is actually think about those ways and try to understand why that you talked about, Gaz. The why is really, really important. You know, why this is happening, and then what we should be actually, what I can do about it as an individual. Because we all understand climate change, it resonates in our lives in different ways.
Do you think there's ever a situation that to help to get that message across and understand the whys? Do you think if you take the UK as an example and our political system, and it's largely two-party, and if you ignore the SNP and the Liberals, which is quite easy to do, do you ever think there's going to get to a situation where those two parties actually agree on a 50-year, 60-year, 70-year plan, and they almost bind to it, publicly say, we've agreed this as the way we're going forward relating to climate, and whichever of us is in power, we are going to work to that. Do you think that's politically something that could ever happen in this country?
At the national scale, no. We're trying to do it at the global scale, aren't we? And it's not working. So we've had 30 to 40 years of global negotiations, and we still see greenhouse gas emissions rise, global warming, temperatures rising. At the national scale, I don't see it. The one thing that they are in agreement with is that climate change is actually real, anthropogenic climate change is real, and we have to do something about it. For me, I'm very, very disillusioned in not just UK politics, but world politics per se. As a political geographer, I just think everything gets reduced to power, and it's about who's in power and who isn't. And I think things like climate change are just used as proxies to try and maintain power, try to win over the electorate. I am quite disillusioned with UK politics. And I know a lot of, like, I'm approaching 50. And I know a lot of young people that I see in and out of the lecture theatre every day are equally disillusioned.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, probably the last few years has made people even more disillusioned than they ever have been before, but don't want to get down that route.
Political route.
No, so we talked about the why, and I think anybody who's ever, you know, worked in any training way at all, you know that getting people on board is to understand the why. So I'd be curious then to know, Andrew, why is it that you are so interested in it? Why is it something that you're passionate about? Why do you care about it? And how do we get people to be as passionate and care as much as you do, or take an interest in the same way that you do?
Yeah, well, my interest started way back in when I was about 17, I think. So I remember watching on Newsround when I was 17, or it might have been the BBC News. I saw the Earth Summit that was held in Rio in 1992. And I was just amazed at all of those global leaders getting together in a room to try and solve environmental issues and try to deal with this idea of sustainable development and trying to tackle poverty and looking at the links between poverty and the environment. So that's what really got me interested in the environment. But it was only peripheral interest then. I really enjoyed history at school. I wanted to be a history teacher. And I did my history degree and decided I didn't want to be a history teacher. So I went and retrained at the University of East Anglia, got an environmental earth sciences degree. So my background is in both earth sciences and human geography. And I wanted to be a volcanologist, to study volcanoes. And then I just sort of fell into environmental management and climate change when I did my master's degree, and then just did my PhD on, you know, sort of environmental governance. And really, just only recently in my career, the last 15 years, I've taken more of an active interest in climate change, because that's an issue that's actually been lurched into the public consciousness. And I knew that it was a very interesting subject, emotive, and it just completely interested me how different people understood climate change in different ways, and how that has led to people basically arguing about climate change. I'm so interested in that. So that was just how my interest has actually formed over the years.
Yeah, just want to sort of take you back to what Dave mentioned a minute ago in terms of the sort of the political parties. And I suppose, you know, you said you couldn't really see it. Would there ever be a time where, Rishi Sunak says, I'm going to do this, and then all the opposition leader says, well, I'll subscribe to that and I'll do that. And is it... And I don't know, but again, is it if Conservatives and Labour were to hook up in the UK, is that just almost a microcosm of the rest of the global and say, well, actually, even if we did, what good could we do just on our own? Because actually, if we don't then get the agreement of China, of America, and that's just a reflection of, in a way, society as a whole. And if you extrapolate that out to Adam, going back to what he very said at the very start of the podcast, well, what can I do? Even if we got Conservative and Labour to agree to a statute that says that they are committed to do X, Y, and Z over a number of years, will they not then feel so, well, what can we do just as one country if we haven't got then the support and the buy-in of every other country? Mm-hmm. So it is a hugely global issue, isn't it? And what you need is you almost need a global resolution. I know that people are working towards it, and I know that every country has different levels of output and different levels of industrialization and carbon output and all of that, but you really do need an absolute global solution to this and not just pockets of people working in isolation.
Yeah, you do. We do need a global solution because climate change is a global problem. But if, for example, in the UK, if the Labour government and the Labour Party and the Conservative Party got together, that does show to the rest of the world that the UK is exhibiting climate leadership.
Yeah.
This is one of the and when you get that ambition and you get the will of countries saying, look, well, look, here we are, we're putting ourselves on the line, this is what we want to do, other countries may tend to follow suit as well. You know, it just starts with one person, okay?
Yes.
So, you know, it could be it could actually be an effective way. Look at, and you know, we were talking about Greta Thunberg earlier before we came on air, and look, Greta just sat outside Swedish Parliament, this 13, 14-year-old girl, and now look at what's happened 7 or 8 years later. The actual mass of support that she's had from the School for Strikes movement is amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just, you know, it has to start somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that unified politics or political statement from a country like the UK, I know that we can sometimes have delusions of grandeur on the world stage nowadays, but we are still a voice, and a lot of countries would look to us and see us as set an example. And if our parliament, with all the 650 MPs from every party that's in there, subscribed to a long-term commitment and stood by it and didn't take the first opportunity, you know, an election's coming or a budget's coming, the first opportunity to undermine it, I think that would make a difference. And I think some countries of similar sizes, they may start in Europe and other places, I think they would start to think, well, if they're doing it, we're not. And they might not do it because they necessarily think it's great or they want to, but it makes it a little bit more uncomfortable for them not to do it if we are. And then if France does it, and then Germany does it, and then Norway does it, or whatever, you know, you're starting to add up, you're only 0.5%, 1/3%, 0.1%, but collectively we might be 15-20%. And then you're looking at America and China, and there's more and more pressure applied for them to do it as well.
It's called the Rocky Balboa theory, isn't it? If you can change, and I can change, and they can change, maybe everybody can change. So
that's going to be the title of my next paper, Adam, I think.
Don't listen to me.
The Rocky effect. I like that. I love that.
I actually do like that. So you have to co-author a paper with me, Adam.
Oh, yeah. Don't tell him that.
Yeah. I'll help in any way I can, which will be very little.
That's about it. You beat me to it, Dave.
Yeah, that's about all I'm good for. So just one thing I want to go back before. We normally wrap these things up round about the hour mark. But you mentioned earlier, you queried earlier about the the phrase climate crisis. Did you want to just extrapolate on that briefly?
Yeah, it's just that when we use those phrases, we're saying that there's climate emergency, climate crisis. And I think that tends to worry people because, you know, it sort of, it captures the climate issue into one thing that we've got to deal with straight away. But we've got other crises as well. We've got a cost of living crisis. We've got biodiversity crisis. I'm just saying that there's other crises as well that we have to deal with a society. And I think a lot of that language can actually be detrimental to individuals actually doing something about climate change because they've become quite anxious about it. Because when we talk of an emergency, it needs to be dealt with straight away. Climate change will not be dealt with straight away with the current political systems that we've got. And, you know, we've touched on that already in the program. So this is why I have some problems with it. I'm guilty of using the words as well. And, you know, these, you know, you get a lot of trendy phrases that come in from academia that sort of find their way into policy realms as well. So there's loads, like sustainable development is a buzzword. How can you develop and then be sustaining? Because to develop, you're going to use up materials. Resilience is another buzzword that's actually been used that you might have heard of. So we're using a lot of buzzwords. Policymakers tend to use a lot of buzzwords to maybe hide the fact that they're not actually doing something about it, or they're just doing the same as what they previously did.
Rehash things, but use different words. People think you're doing something different.
Yeah, to make the electorate think they're actually doing something. Look, they're using the word net zero. They're using resilience.
And sustainable developments is actually just slightly less damaging developments, essentially, isn't it? Because if you're building with concrete and you're covering up green spaces, how can it be sustainable?
Exactly. And the thing of a sustainable development, they always look at this idea of the tripartite of economy, society, and environment. And again, the economy is included in that. So, you know, how much economy and how much environment, we don't know. There's strong and weak forms of sustainability as well. So, you know, obviously the weaker forms of sustainability favour economic development over, obviously, environmental protection.
So I think we're coming towards the end, but I think we ought to just ask a fairly broad question, Andrew. Are you hopeful?
Well, I am hopeful, and I've just led the Climate Assembly process with my colleagues at Lincoln City Council, the climate change manager there, and a colleague from an organisation called Local Motion. And we've called the Assembly process hashtag Climate Hope Lincoln. So we need to have hope. If someone like me who advocates climate action doesn't sound hopeful, then I dare not think about what the average Joe would actually think about it. We need to be hopeful, but we have to also think about the way that we can change as human beings. We will have to adapt. We can't live life in the same way that we've lived life for the last 100-150 years, because we've got the problem of population explosion. We've got, you know, 9 billion people, you know, in the world. 60, 70 years ago, how many people did we have in the world? I don't know. 6.5 million. So it's 6.5 billion. So it's rising sort of almost exponentially, population. Yeah. And this is why the effects of climate change are even more exacerbated because of that.
No, I was just going to wrap up. I think, you know, I think we need to be hopeful. I think there needs to be an element of realism, because I think blind hope is also dangerous. So I think there's, yes, we have to be hope, as we have to have hope, but as a nation, as a global entity, we have to have a realism. And I think we have to look at the incremental steps. What are the incremental steps that we can all do that then, when you add all of those incremental steps up, you see a significant change, because I can't personally make a significant change. What I can do is I can make an incremental step. Adam can make an incremental step, and so can Dave, and so can yourself, and so can everybody. And by adding up all of those incremental steps, what you hope to see there is then effect to change. But I think there has to be a realism. I think there has to be almost an aspirational target, but also a realistic target, because I think blind hope is dangerous in some cases. And I think therefore, yes, we have to have hope and we have to believe that we can get there. But I think it's recognizing the steps that we then need to take in order to get to the end of that process.
Yeah. And to make us do that as individuals, we need strong climate leadership from actors that are in the public realm, in the public domain. So when we have inconsistent policies coming from the Conservative government, which we've seen, then that doesn't make people hopeful, does it? It shows that we have a weak leadership that doesn't know what they're doing on climate change, and then we can't be bothered.
No, yeah.
No. What about you, Dave? Dave, you asked the question there. Do you have a new hope, having listened to this episode, and are you hopeful in general?
I am hopeful, because I see it in my own kids, and particularly Albert, that he's very environmentally conscious and he understands that now. He can't be alone in the younger generation. And Greta and the work she does, that obviously attracts a lot of young people to participate in those views and have those conversations. Things like this podcast, our humble little podcast, you know, people are going to listen, people are going to learn, people might make some of those incremental changes to their behaviours. I do think it's possibly humans being humans and politics being politics. It probably is going to get worse before people think, oh dear, we really ought to do something now. And I guess the hope is that that's not too late. So overall, am I hopeful? Yes, but it will probably be very last minute when the thing that's very significant happens. It'll almost be too late, but I think we'll just about do it. Otherwise, I'm going to take Albert's earlier question, get him switched.
Why not? You know, in terms of myself, you know, I guess I've listened to everything that Andrew has said. Yeah, I've definitely learned a little bit in terms of, you know, understanding some of the terminology that perhaps I've heard used and has been misrepresented perhaps in the media and by politics. Am I hopeful? I'm probably not as hopeful as you guys, because I have very little faith in British politics. I have very little faith in world politics. And I do think that while there are folks out there that are happy to line their own pockets, they'll perhaps make the wrong choices on our behalf. And I know it's a huge challenge that's ahead of us. Maybe we'll get there. Who knows? I hope that my kids do see some change. And like you say, I hope it's our kids that do obviously take it on board and make the change, because old fogies like us are probably too stuck in our ways. We want our petrol cars and our V8 engines, and we're quite happy with all of that. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong, but I fear I'm not. And this just in, Gaz has just agreed to go vegetarian with me. To make his incremental changes.
Is that right? Oh, yeah. Okay. I thought you were going to say Gaz is going to vow never to budgie smugglers again. That's the change I can. Anyway,
small changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't remember the exact phrase, but you know, if you haven't got hope at Pandora's box, what is it? Despair or whatever it is you got. So I think it's important that we have hope. I think it's important that we hold on to the notion that we can be better and we will be better and we will make a change and we can affect a change. I think there's a long way to go before that movement becomes so widespread that the perception is that we are making a change. And whilst we can do that individually, I think we've got a long way to go before we get to the point where everybody is on the same hymn sheet as such. Look, you know, I've really enjoyed this episode. It's great when we have episodes that challenges intellectually, challenge the way that we perceive things and challenge the way that we think about how things are portrayed in the media and the political sort of impact. So been fascinated by it. Andrew, I just want to say thank you very much for your time spent with us. It has been great. Really, really, really enjoyed it. And I said it at the start, it's always great when we have guests on, first-time guests, and found it fascinating, found the topic fascinating. And I genuinely do, or I'd like to think that we have hope and that we can effect a change.
Indeed. So Andrew, would you like to say your goodbyes to our listeners?
Yeah, I'd just like to say thank you for putting up with me for the last hour, Rod. Just finally, I am hopeful of human nature, not so hopeful like you, Adam, of politics more generally, both the UK and global. So I think it's going to come down to human action from the average person in the street rather than putting our faith in politics.
Yeah, amen. Amen to that. And I suppose when we close this up, I'm going to take it to where Gas so nearly took it and quoting Michael Jackson there about starting with the man in the mirror and asking him to make that change. So I'll leave you with that thought tonight, and I'll bid you all a fond farewell.